History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there where you live that really need to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we venture down that path, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that's going to be the case today as we visit with 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California. In the military, he was a pilot. As a civilian, a longtime teacher. And in his retirement, he's made an impact on so many families in a unique and powerful way. So we're going to hear about all of that, but as always, we want to go back to the beginning. You grew up in a family with six kids?
Yes.
And why don't you tell everybody where it was you were born?
I was born in Merrifield, Saskatchewan, Canada, and moved to Bakersfield when I was 2 years old.
And have you ever been back there to where you were born?
Yes, I have. With my older brother, who was 7 years old when he left the farm.
Well, and I understand there's a pretty interesting method that your older brother used to get to school back when your family was north of the border.
Yes, it was. He had a horse and had 7 miles to go to get to and from school.
Did you ever hear him tell that story and wish you would have had the chance to do that?
No, I never wished to have that opportunity.
Well, and since you've spent almost the rest of your life here in Bakersfield, except for when the government sent you overseas, have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had your family stayed up there instead of here in oil country in Kern County?
Oh, yes. It would have been so much different. We'd still be on a farm. My dad had two sections that he used for wheat farm. I know he was very busy with it, but they would bring a harvesting crew in each year because they would have to cut the wheat and then put it in like a bundle, and then it would stand, and then it would have to age, in other words, dry out a little before the harvester would come in, and then the harvester would come in, and there would be a large crew, and my mom would have to feed all those people.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of guys over the years who they were born in Oklahoma or Arkansas or somewhere back in that part of the country, and they came here during that Dust Bowl migration. But what was it that triggered your family's move to this area?
Well, my mother came down for a visit to her parents, and it was on Christmas Day. My older sister and older brother, my twin sister, and myself were the ones that came down with her on the train.
And what are some of your favorite childhood memories of growing up here in Kern County in the 20s and 30s?
Actually, it'd be going to the rural schools like Petroleum School and Aztec School.
And did you always get along with all five of your siblings?
Oh, never had any problems with any of them, ever.
Knowing what I know about your life since then, and especially how you've used your musical ability in recent decades to make a difference in many, many lives. I guess that gift you got when you were 8 years old was pretty significant for you?
Yes, it was. Very much so. Brand new trumpet. It was really something. Actually, it was a godsend. My twin sister played piano, and my older brother played violin, and oldest brother played clarinet. And it was a musical family, and we'd stand around the piano in the evenings and sing songs such as When the Moon Comes Over the Mountain and so forth.
So that was a requirement in the Otto family? You had to play an instrument of some kind?
No, it wasn't a requirement because my younger sister didn't have any desire to play an instrument, but I was very pleased that they gave me the trumpet because I was able to use it in military and play in, for example, at Ouachita College when we were waiting to be classified, whether you didn't know whether you're going to be a pilot, navigator, or bombardier. Actually, what it was some advanced courses in calculus and so forth, because you didn't know, as I said, whether you're going to be a navigator, bombardier, or pilot. And in my case, I was hoping I was going to be a pilot because I had spent so many years as a pilot.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. We'll come back to your musical talents, and if people want to see and hear your trumpet ability in action, even at age 97, they can find a little video online at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. As for this pilot thing, how far back does that go? How young were you when you became enamored with this idea of flying?
I was going to Bakersfield Junior College, and they had a course by Roy Pemberton here in Bakersfield. The course was taken during your last year of junior college, and it amounted to learning to fly, and that was what I enjoyed very much. So it was a light airplane that we were flying, actually practicing over where I was raised, and it was very much at home in it. You had a cross-country that you took solo, and you had other flights with the instructor, forced landings, etc.
Well, and you mentioned your instructor. And here in 2019, flying is so commonplace. It's ubiquitous. Everybody just about has flown somewhere at some point, not necessarily in the cockpit, but they're used to flying. But can you help us understand here, you know, in the first quarter century of human flight, how big of a novelty or how unique that was?
It absolutely was a novelty at the time. I liked to fly, and when we finished the course here with Roy Pemberton, while you got your private pilot's license, my number at that time was 70736. The Wright brothers had one and two, and I don't know. Roy Pemberton, his number is in my flight book when he gave me my checks for flying, and he was in something like 23 or 2400, which is, they no longer use that system, of course. They use your Social Security number today.
And now, all these years later, I guess we're about 80 years later now. There are probably millions of Americans who have become pilot, but you are one of the first 71,000 Americans to get that license.
That's right.
And you would use it, and you would also be doing some flying for the military. Let me ask you about the time leading up to World War II, because here you've already graduated high school. You're going to college. Did you hear the rumblings that, hey, these other conflicts that are rising up around the world, America may get sucked into this?
Well, first came to my attention when we were living in Whittier, and I remember on December 7th, Sunday morning in at Whittier, and my dad and I were listening to the radio and hearing all of the news about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, and that sort of woke up the world.
How big an impact did that make on you to hear that news?
Very much so, because I was working for Douglas Aircraft at the time, and the military was seeking pilots, and I had a private license at the time, and so I just went into to their program and went on, got a commercial instrument rating and so forth, and then it made it when I was in cadets to go through primary, secondary, and advanced. Well, it was very simple because I already had a pilot's license, a commercial license with an instrument rating.
You mentioned Douglas Aircraft. That's another thing that some people aren't aware of, how much was already being produced before America was in the war, that we were sending certain pieces of equipment over to the British. And of course, it really ramped up after Pearl Harbor. And Douglas wasn't the only aircraft company building planes in Southern California. But what were you doing specifically for Douglas Aircraft?
I was an inspector, what you called a line inspector, like when a wing, mid-wing would be bolted on and so forth. The inspector was there to make sure and put his stamp on that the torque on the nuts were at the required amount number.
And does that mean that the fact that you were doing that job, does that mean you could have gotten a deferment because of that job if you wanted to?
Oh, yes. But I didn't care for a deferment. I wanted to continue flying.
And one more thing about where you were at that place in time, if we look back now. You mentioned Whittier College, home of the Poets, which is one of the most colorful nicknames in college athletics. But a very small school there in Southern California who had a pretty famous student, probably just a few years ahead of you, huh?
Yes, Nixon was one of theirs. In fact, he lived right across the street from my dad, and I remember a loaf of bread being delivered to my dad instead of to Nixon, and I think my dad took the loaf of bread over to Nixon. Across the street.
Would it ever have dawned on you that there was a future U.S. president living across the street?
No, it never bothered me in the least. It's just another neighbor.
Well, and can you help us understand how things changed after Pearl Harbor? What were the most significant differences that you saw in that immediate aftermath?
Well, a whole way of life, because the Japanese became an enemy. We had had a family of Japanese on another lease. I guess I can name them. The family was Yamashita, and mother and son, youngest son Charlie, went back to Japan, and the father, I guess he was getting information on oil production in the United States, and he was sending that information to his, I guess, constituents in Japan.
Well, that's kind of eerie, isn't it? These are people you've been acquainted with all these years, and you never would have suspected, it sounds like.
That's right. You would not suspect them as being detrimental to our way of life.
And if we look back now, with hindsight, we see that 120,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and stuck behind barbed wire, and the vast majority of them never did anything like that. But at that point, as I understand it, I wasn't there. It sounds like that suspicion was commonplace, that because there were isolated cases like you're talking about, there was this kind of air or backdrop of suspicion towards a lot of them?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I have a very close friend who was a pilot, and he was a pilot during the Vietnam War when he lived here. Why, we were great friends, and his family was put in an internment camp, and his dad was also one of the ones that was in Germany, and you've seen the film on the Japanese and what they did in Germany during the war.
The 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Gopher Broke unit?
I presume that's what it was. I don't recall.
Well, and so you said you didn't want a deferment for working in the aircraft industry or for going to school. You wanted to fly. A lot of guys wanted to be pilots in World War II. Were there some hurdles you had to clear? I mean, I know you already had your civilian pilot's license with the instrument rating, but along that course, going from cadet to actual Army Air Corps pilot, were there some challenges in your way?
Oh, yes. there were hurdles to do all the way along the way.
What were some of the more challenging ones?
Oh, pass the various tests that they had. For example, you had an instrument ride, you'd have check rides, and you would hope that you did well on them. I evidently did, and I did have a couple of forced landings. I remember one when we were in primary, while we were flying the PT-19, and there were a few, you might say, flights that weren't required by the book. And I was doing what was called a vertical snap roll. And when I finished the snap roll, while the engine quit, and there I was, miles from base, and no engine. So what it is, pick out a field to land in, a forced landing. And I picked one up. It was about a mile square of a wheat land that had just been harvested, and set it down in the middle of the field, knocked on the door of the farmhouse. And the woman glanced, and I had my helmet on, and I had to grab that and pull it off and let her know that I was a human being. And so then she came to the door, and I asked her if I could use her phone. She said, "We don't have a phone." I said, no one has a phone out in this area. And she says, "The nearest phone is at an intersection, and it's over a mile away." But she said, I'll go down there, and I'll call." So she did. And when she came back, she had a little number 10 can and about three or four ice cubes in it and a Coke in that for me.
Times have changed, haven't they? And you said that was one of the forced landings that you made. Do you remember the others?
Oh, yes. That was when they brought an ambulance out to the field. And I was put in the ambulance to go back, but there was nothing wrong. I did hit my head on the top of the door where the door would close on the ambulance and a bruised head. Other than that, why it all went well.
So I got to get this straight now. So this is the incident where you're out of power after that snap roll. You have to put it down in a field. You knock on the door. There's no telephone, but she brings you a Coke in a can. You're not injured at all.
Oh, no.
Until the ambulance gets there.
No. Well, this was normal because there was a test pilot that came out with the crew and the pickup truck with a mechanic. And the mechanic knew exactly what was wrong with it because he lifted the hood on the side and pulled out a ball peen hammer and tapped on the carburetor and I guess loosened the float where it would move up and down. And the test pilot fired it up and took it off.
The sending an ambulance out was standard operating procedure, but I do believe, unless I'm forgetting someone, I believe you have to be the first person I've ever met who was uninjured when the ambulance arrived and then was injured by the actual ambulance that came to rescue him.
More or less, yes.
And when you look back on stories like that, and aviation, like we discussed, was so primitive at this time, there was so much that nobody knew because nobody had ever done it before. Do you ever look back at situations like that and think, you know, I was maybe in a little more danger than I realized I was?
Yes, I have. I've felt that I was very fortunate all the way through in my flying career to have just a couple of three forced landings, actually, at different times in life and so forth.
That situation back in Texas during training is something Bob Otto can chuckle about now, but there would be more harrowing moments in the cockpit to come, and we're going to get to that. Time for our first break, but head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video related to Bob Otto's story, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California. Thanks to his son John for letting us know about his amazing father. I have a few thoughts from John added onto the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. But let's jump back in with Bob right now. So here you are. You're a pilot in World War II. Were you expecting to get sent overseas? Did you have an idea of a specific plane that you wanted to fly in combat?
Well, yes, on all single engine. When we finished primary, well, you went to secondary, which was BT-13s, then advanced, which was the AT-6, which I really liked. I really liked that airplane. And then all the aerobatics and so forth. And in fact, I had a Czech pilot, and he tried to do everything to get away from me, and he could not get away from me. And he finally says, well, let's head back to base.
So when you master the AT-6, what was next for a lot of guys was, depending on the time of the war it was, they're going to go fly a P-40, maybe a P-47, eventually maybe a P-51. What happened in your case?
Well, ours was a P-40, which I got to fly. It was a very interesting aircraft, and I know it was redlined at 425, something like that. And I always wanted to speed, and I remember taking it up to 39,000 feet. We were on oxygen. Took it up to, I was on oxygen. Took it up to that altitude and started to dive and got it up to 425 and started my pull out and landed the aircraft, came back in, and I had an earache when I got back on base. And so with the flight surgeon looked at it and said, "You burst your eardrum." And I thought, boy, that's the end of my flying, you know. But within 30 days, it was all healed.
Did that teach you a lesson, that just because that red line's there doesn't mean you have to touch it?
No. You're always looking for something more encouraging, you might say.
So here we have a situation, even though you went in very early in the war, you were already a pilot before Pearl Harbor happened, you enlisted shortly thereafter, you never did get sent overseas in World War II. What were the priorities Uncle Sam had for you?
During World War II, I got as far as Lincoln, Nebraska, which was for overseas shipment to the Far East. And I presumed I'd be headed for China or Burma or that area. And I was walking into the mess hall one day at noon, and the mess sergeant came over to me and said, "Sir, the war is over. Japan surrendered today." So then I stayed there for probably 3 or 4 weeks and then got orders to go to Sherman, Texas as a T-6 instructor. And I thought, who in the world will I be instructing? The war's over. There are no students. Well, I got back there, and my students were the combat people that were returning from India and China, and they had to be checked out in the T-6 so they could get their flight pay. That's what I did, checked them out and more or less doing aerobatics with them.
When you say you presume you would have been sent to that part of the war, an often overlooked part of that war, the China-Burma-India theater, do you say that because that's where so many P-40s were with General Chenault and his Flying Tigers?
That's right, yes.
And when you said, you know, that was a very interesting way for you to find out that the war was over, did you have any emotions wrapped up in that news?
No, it was just nice to see that we're at peace with the world.
And you would end up flying 56 combat missions in Korea not too many years later. But I think something pretty important in your life happened between World War II and Korea. You married a special young lady named Etta?
That's right. You know, the love of my life.
What's the story there? How did you two meet?
When I was going to Whittier College, my sister-in-law worked for the telephone company and went on a blind date with this young lady, and that was the beginning of 70 years of best life ever.
Yeah, and I'm sure she had some nervous nights and some long nights and a lot of prayers for a couple years when you were over in Korea flying for the U.S. Air Force by that time. But what about that in-between period? When World War II ended, did you know what was going to be next? Did you have a plan for what you wanted to do with a life that maybe was a little clearer now that the world wasn't inflamed in this giant war?
Oh, yes. I wanted to finish college and get a degree. And my mother had been a school teacher, and my older sister is a school teacher. That was more or less what my aim was. So I went to Whittier College, got my bachelor's degree, later went on, got a master's, of course, and a teaching credential, and taught for about 2 years, I guess. And then I was recalled for the Korean War.
I guess I should come back also, because you mentioned when we talked about your trumpet that you had it with you throughout your time in the service. What did that mean to you, and how did you put that talent to use when you were in uniform?
Well, when we were at Arkadelphia, Arkansas, at a CTD, College Training Detachment, they had a band, and on Saturday mornings, why we would usually march downtown, which was just a few blocks away from the college in Arkadelphia. Didn't play trumpet in that band because the student who was directing it needed a player for a larger instrument, a bass, so I played that in the marching band. I was also the bass bugler. Our quarters were in a huge auditorium, and they'd taken the seats out, and we had double bunk beds, but they'd cut the legs so that the beds would be level, and my horn was placed under my end of the bed, and in the morning at 5, the officer of the day would come by and waken me, and I would just stand at the side of my bed and play reveille, and in other words, can't get them up, and in the auditorium, and that would really echo.
Well, and if we look at the odd symmetry of it, there are a lot of servicemen who had their slumber rudely interrupted by your reveille, and many years later you would play the final notes honoring their memories for thousands of funerals, and we'll get to that. But I'm curious for you. Here you are. World War II is over. You were ready to fly for your country then. Now you've finished up school. You're a teacher. You're married. You've got the start to a pretty exciting life. And then, as you told us, you get recalled for the Korean War. Did that blindside you at all? Was that an interruption or an inconvenience? How did you feel about that?
No, there was no problem about it. It was just part of being trained for military, and I was checked out in a different aircraft, the Douglas B-26, and I became a co-pilot on a Douglas B-26.
And that's a very different aircraft from the P-40 you'd been flying at the end of World War II. Help us understand what that airplane is all about, what it's designed to do, what its capabilities were, and how you warmed up to it.
Well, the Douglas B-26 is a twin-engine aircraft. Got R-2800s, so they just gave me training in it. I was a co-pilot for Stan Fields. I was very fortunate to have him as my first pilot. The reason being, he had flown the A-26, which was the forerunner of the Douglas B-26, in Europe during World War II, and was very familiar with the aircraft.
And what were the capabilities of the B-26? How much firepower did you have? How maneuverable was it?
Well, our aircraft was a night outfit, so they were all painted black. We had 6 forward-firing 50s on the wing, not to be mistaken with the solid-nose B-26 that had 6 forward-firing 50s in the nose, plus those in the wing. Of course, as I said, ours did not have that. We were a night outfit, put in 56 missions, 50 night missions, 6 daylight missions. I guess that the 50 missions were required for rotation. 50 night ones were what I presume were required.
And this was with the 731st Bomb Squadron in Korea. How difficult was it to head overseas, to kiss Etta goodbye, not knowing if you're going to come back or not, because this is going to be some pretty dangerous work you're doing.
Yes, well, we took our own airplane. We were out on the desert here. We flew simulated missions. Then on one early morning, while we took off from the desert and came through Bakersfield and on up to Sacramento, and in Sacramento, while they pulled the radar equipment out of our aircraft and put in a 1,100-gallon bladder tank, so that we could fly from Sacramento to Hawaii. And that was a very long flight. That was 18 hours sitting in the same seat. Of course, you're sitting on a one-man life raft, and you have a backpack parachute that you're wearing. We would just trade back and forth flying. I guess I slept a little too along the way. We island hopped from there, and the first island was a man-made island. It was man-made during World War II. It was 1 mile long and about a half mile wide. We landed on that, and then you made a curve around, and they refueled your aircraft, and you got 8 hours sleep, and then you went on to Kwajalein. There was a very unusual situation that happened in Kwajalein, because just before we landed, there was a Navy R-5D, which like a C-54. It had 26 nurses on board, and when that aircraft broke ground, why, there was an explosion, and the aircraft hit the water and so forth, and all those people lost their lives. And it was probably one of the worst scenes that I have ever seen in my life took place, with the loss of those nurses and the sharks that were in the water at the time. And, of course, the aircraft broke up. And I think about it today and think how horrible it is.
Yeah. And just to have the perspective, I mean, here's your welcome to the war. You're not even over where the combat is yet. You're just landing at Kwajalein, and you stumble across the aftermath of this tragic crash. And at that point, you can see the sharks in a frenzy around that wreckage?
Yes, horrible. And the next day, we refueled. We've had our good night's rest, and we take off, and we don't get quite out to our point of no return, where instead of returning to the base that you started from, you'd go to your next base. But we hadn't quite reached that. We were out about 3 hours and 15 minutes, and we lost an engine. I say lost an engine, but to use that term as a pilot means that the engine quit on you, and we had to feather that engine. We had to return into Kwajalein. We came back, and the whole runway was lined with people looking for what they had seen the day before. Of course, when we landed on a single engine, our crew chief, who was the mechanic for our aircraft, got out, got on his hands and knees. He got out of the nose of the aircraft, which is a glass nose, got on the ground, kissed the ground.
Well, and what about you? Because, I mean, 2 days in a row, you're confronted with pretty visible underscores and reminders that this is a life and death situation. How did you handle that?
No problem. That's what you're hired for, if you want to call it being hired, and that's what you're trained for. In fact, it was a very interesting flight. Well, we went from Kwajalein to Guam, then Guam all the way to Tachikawa. I got in a poker game in Tachikawa the first night that we were there, and I won a little over $400. And so when we made it to our next base, which was an Australian base at Iwakuni, there were a number of Australian aircraft, and they had float aircraft also. Well, at any rate, I bought a movie camera. That's where most of my pictures came from.
Yeah, and you still have this, and your son has converted it to DVD. And if you go online to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see a little bit of that film that's nearly 70 years old that Bob took way back when during the Korean War. You said that none of those things bothered you. And I know there was a lot in front of you, 56 missions and most of those at night. But are you saying that you never experienced that fear or question of whether you might leave Etta a widow?
No, you're trained to do what you were to do, and you did it. I never let it bother me.
Well, let's talk about these missions. 56 missions, 50 at night, 6 during the day. Were those daytime missions different in nature than the nighttime ones?
Yes, because you were a target that could be seen during the daytime. Those were a little different type of mission, you might say, than the night ones. The night ones, why, first thing you did was usually about the first 6 of our 50 missions, why we would put Soul City Sioux off the air. And what you'd do, you'd have her on what we call our bird dog, which is a compass. You would have the compass point towards the station, and you'd head towards the station, and you'd hear in the background that they're having an air raid. Of course, that's you that's going in there, and you'd drop a 100-pounder on the transmitter, and then they'd go off the air, and they'd be off the air then for maybe the entire evening before they could get back on again.
Well, and some people listening have never heard of Soul City Sioux. Maybe they've heard of Tokyo Rose or Axis Annie or Axis Sally or something like that. Same kind of idea. What did Soul City Sioux talk about when she was on the radio?
In her very sexy voice, she would say, "Come on, boys, come on over to our side. We'll give you lots of food, good food. You have a nice warm bed to sleep in at night." Of course, it was all a bunch of lies, but it was like, as you say, Axis Annie and Tokyo Rose.
So it was a little propaganda, and you had a pretty unique way of silencing it there. You just took out the transmitters. How many times do you think you did that?
I'm sure we did it about 6 or 7 times. On preference, what we would do would be heading for your target area, and then all of a sudden you'd make the turn left so that they wouldn't know that you, in other words, you'd kind of surprise them when you'd come in. That's when you'd drop a 100-pounder, and our navigator bombardier would do that, of course, and then do a 180, or if there was anything that moved, why, you would strafe it. And a couple of times there were things that were moving. For example, there was an ammo carrier. We strafed that and stopped it.
And you told us you were the co-pilot. You're in the right seat on this B-26. So what did that mean for your role during one of those missions? What were you supposed to do?
Well, you're an observer. If anything moves, why, you let the pilot know where it is and so forth. When you cross the bomb line, I had a very good vision of trains at night. In fact, the first pilot, Stan Fields, one night we attacked 9 trains in one night is literally unheard of, you might say. that what's a train look like at night? It's a white streak. There's a, you know, there's a railroad track down there. So then when the train is on the tracks and so forth, while it's giving off steam, I don't know. I was just able to pick out those trains at night, some nine of them. When you hit a train at night with your 50 calibers, it's quite interesting because the steam goes out on each side and it becomes a line. And then if you stop the train, then you can strafe it and you get a number of secondary explosions. And that's what we were able to do nine different times.
Only because you spotted all nine of those.
Yes. Well, you were able to. I was able to see them, point them out to the first pilot that was in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I hope this isn't too broad a generality here, but one of the things I've heard from a lot of the veterans I've talked to who served in Korea, and especially a lot of those guys had also served in World War II, and one of the differences that they've pointed out is that during the Korean War, they felt there were a lot of things that were off limits to them, that they might have been able to further the cause or do more damage, but there were areas they were told to stay away from. Is that something that you experienced as well, some boundaries or parameters that you had to maintain?
Yes, but I don't recall it being a problem. For example, I remember about 5 o'clock in the morning when the sun was just coming up, where we were in the northern part of Korea, and we looked across the Yalu River, and you could see all of these Chinese fighter aircraft. They certainly were tempting, but you didn't dare go across that river.
And why wouldn't you dare?
Because it would create an international incident.
And that wasn't the only time he'd find himself in a position like that. When we come back with 97-year-old Bob Otto, what might have been his closest call during the Korean War, and hear how and why Bob has served and honored thousands of his fellow veterans and their families in the years since he left the Air Force. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross. But if you had him as a high school teacher, he probably wasn't talking about that or the 56 missions he flew in B-26s with the 731st Bomb Squadron during the Korean War. 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California, has preserved a lot of his records and paperwork from his time in the Air Force. I see a lot of missions, and all it says next to it is classified, classified, classified. I mean, it's been almost 70 years. That stuff has to be declassified by now, right?
Possibly so, but my Form 5 shows that every mission that I went on was classified. So be it.
And why was that? What was so sensitive about what you were doing that that classification was necessary?
I'll use one example. That is one evening, or one night, I'll call it, about close to midnight, while we were looking for targets, and there's nothing moving. The navigator bombardier puts us on a course towards the Russian border. The navigator has just announced that it's about time we turned around, and when we start our turnaround, why, the whole sky lights up. And so I presume it's the Russians with their radar, and they have an unidentified on their sights, so they're let loose with it. Of course, we were never hit by any of it.
So just to make sure I understand you correctly, and sorry for all the questions. So the need for classification was, this is in a sense a proxy war. The U.S. is not at war with the USSR, but you're there engaging Soviet forces, and if that were actually taking place or known to have taken place, that would create a whole lot of issues for a whole lot of people.
Yes, that's the reason the navigator would not let you get too close, and he would tell you to do a 180, which you did, and get out of the area.
So there aren't any secrets you've been keeping for 70 years that you feel like sharing right now?
No, I have no secrets to give out at this time. I don't know.
Well, I know you do have a story of a pretty significant close call, and I'm sure that wasn't the only one in 56 missions. Maybe I should ask that. How frequent of an occurrence was it that, as you targeted enemy forces on the ground, there was return fire headed for your B-26?
Quite often. In fact, as I stated before, as soon as you cross the bomb line, why, anything that moves becomes a target, and you're a target. I recall on one, especially, we had strafed a marshaling yard. In so doing, we got lots of return fire, and we had a 20-millimeter go through our left wing and went through one of our own ammo boxes, 50 caliber boxes, where the hole where it went in to the wing, so forth, it took out about a foot square area. I recall seeing an area inside of the wing that was burning, and I couldn't understand what in the world, what's causing the fire in there. So anytime you're hit, you're required to land at the nearest friendly field. So, of course, we had to land at the nearest friendly field, and we got out on the wing with a flashlight and looked in there. And what had happened was the 20-millimeter had gone through one of our own 50-caliber boxes, and it had broken the casing on a couple of rounds, and that was the powder falling out of the casing and burning in the wing. So we could have had a dangerous situation there, but we were very fortunate.
So what were those moments like on your plane among your crew as you're sitting in that right seat looking past your first pilot, and beyond him in that left wing is this glow that just won't stop?
It's kind of hairy.
Was there discussion of perhaps bailing out?
Oh, no. I don't think we would bail out unless there were really something explosive taking place and so forth. No, as I said, any time you were hit, you had to land at the nearest friendly field and assess your damage. And we'd had that probably two or three different times.
So that's not the only close call you experienced?
No. We were hit a few times. Very fortunate.
What's the closest you think anything came to you personally?
Probably closest would be a hit in the wing, so forth.
Well, and you said, and maybe it was an understatement, you said that could have been a dangerous situation on your hands there. In each of those wings, as you told us earlier, you have 350 caliber machine guns in each wing and ammunition in those wings as well that are feeding those guns. And that's what this enemy bullet hit. It's burning the powder that leaked out of one of those shells. But, I mean, what's your guess? If that were to happen 50 times exactly the way it did, how many of those times would it actually work out the way it worked out for you?
It's hard to say. Each hit is different, and we were just very fortunate.
And you were just talking about the work you did, that one of the things that would make your missions more successful, and when you would spot those planes and you guys would unload on them, that you could set off secondary explosions because of what they were carrying. Couldn't that very well have happened in your wing there?
Trains, yes. But it was, let's put it this way, it was exciting.
But, I mean, I'm not misunderstanding the physics of it, am I? I mean, that round from the enemy could have set off some of that ammunition in your wing and could have taken your wing off.
Oh, yes, it's very possible. We were very fortunate.
Yeah, and a couple sons and grandkids and great-grands that are thankful that that worked out the way it did. Anything else from your time in the Korean War that you look back on with particular satisfaction or fondness?
Nothing having to do with fondness, because war is, as everyone has said, war is hell. That's the way I felt about that one, but I was very fortunate.
And I've seen your medals. I saw the Air Medal with quite a few clusters representing multiple awards, and I also saw the Distinguished Flying Cross. And I've had a few guys tell me that they handed them out like candy, but I've learned that that was not true. You had to do something to deserve a DFC. So what's your understanding of why you're one of those people who can display that medal?
Well, the first pilot is the one that put me in for it, and I didn't even know I was going to get it. And actually, I was leaving the base. I had finished my tour. I was leaving that base to become a radar operator as such. I ended up getting DFC and 5 air medals.
Do you have an understanding of what you did that your first pilot put you in for it?
Yes, the article has to do with being close to some mountains on the right-hand side that he couldn't see, and he didn't want, and we were after a train, and he didn't want it to get too close to them, so he asked me to take over, and I took over and was able to fly the aircraft away from the mountain area, line it up for him on his strafing mission on the train.
And that wasn't the only time you had to take over the controls. The other one I know about, I don't think the first pilot wanted you to take over the controls. You talked about your esteem and respect for Fields and what a luxury it was for you to be with a guy who had flown the same kind of aircraft in World War II. But later on, they rotated some other pilots through.
A couple of what I called desk jockeys. I lacked a few missions to get out, and so I flew with these two gentlemen, lieutenant colonels, and one was the navigator, bombardier, and the other was the first pilot, and I was second pilot. I had saw this train, and I said, there's a train out there at the time it was about 9 o'clock. They said, where, you know, and I finally said, well, let me put the nose on it. So I put the nose right on where the train was, and they still did not see that train. And the train at night, of course, there are no lights or anything like that. What it is a line of steam. You know, there's a railroad track there, and you know that the steam is there, so it has to be a train. And as I say, they never saw that, but I had seen 9 of them prior to that with other pilots.
So you just finally had enough and said, I've got to take over here?
Yeah, I did. Well, actually, I had to reach over and activate the weaponry so that it would fire, and then reached across and pulled the trigger on his yoke. The yoke is what you use to fly the aircraft with.
Did he ever say anything to you about that?
No comment whatsoever. Of course, he was a lieutenant colonel, and I was only a first lieutenant.
It's been so long since the Korean War, and many have called it the forgotten war. Some have said it was an unfinished war because of the way it came to a stalemate. How do you see or understand the significance of what you and so many other Americans did over there during those years?
What a job that you were trained for, and carry it out. That's what we tried to do.
And have you ever had occasion to come across someone who benefited from what America did in that intervention? People from South Korea who owe their freedom to all those Americans?
Yes, we have a local woman here in Bakersfield that has a Korean restaurant. When I talked to her about the missions and so forth, she was in North Korea at the time, and she was in Pyongyang, and she said that her mother used to take her when she was a baby, hold her and bend over to make sure that she might not be hit by enemy fire.
And she's welcomed you there as an honored guest because she appreciates what you did. She knows how much of a difference it made.
She seems like a grateful person.
Well, you know, I've interviewed quite a few World War II vets who, especially if they were in the Navy and they're at sea for 3 or 4 years, and then they get home and they see a child who maybe they knew before the war, or maybe was born while they were actually at sea, and, you know, obviously that kid isn't going to recognize him. But I understand it was a different member of the Otto family who didn't recognize you when you got back to the States?
Oh, the dog, yes. I'd flown into Sacramento, gotten on a bus to Bakersfield, and when I got out at the end of the bus, I got a cab home. When I got out of the cab to go up to the back door, why, Cindy, our black Cocker Spaniel, did nothing but bark at me.
I'm guessing Etta recognized you, though.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But that was nice because we had a 30-day delay en route. Then we were able to drive back to Langley Air Force Base. Being as I had been a teacher and so forth, I knew exactly what it was being. That was as a ground school instructor.
And that wouldn't be the only thing you'd teach. Back here in Bakersfield, you spent 3 decades in education, teaching history and geography and public speaking at East High School, home of the Blades. And I guess that eagle eye that helped you spot all those trains helped you with coaching a specific club there on campus too, huh?
Oh, yes. We had a rifle club there, and that's one that I really enjoyed because I was teaching marksmanship and safety for NRA, National Rifle Association, of which I'd been a member, life member for years. It was great teaching those youngsters safety and marksmanship. Had some great people in those classes.
And some of them may be listening right now. One of the radio stations that airs Hometown Heroes is in Bakersfield, KNZR. And I imagine you have a lot of former students listening. And there also have to be quite a few people listening whose lives have been touched by you in another way. We talked about your trumpet. But where did the idea come from for you to play taps at the memorial services of thousands, not tens, not hundreds, but thousands of deceased veterans over a 30-year period?
Greenlawn River, you might, Boulevard, they might have started it. They would ask me to, they would call and say, could you come to and do a veteran's funeral service, play taps for us? And so there might be one every couple of weeks or so when this first happened. And then, of course, as time went on, why the number of members of the service that we lost became greater and greater, and it wasn't long until it was almost a permanent thing. We started doing it at the National Cemetery also. Our 7216 VFW had a crew. We would do the veterans' military rites.
And anybody who's ever been at a service like that knows the power. And it's not about me, but I identify with that moment too. I think I shared with you when my grandfather, a decorated World War II veteran, passed away. I had a gentleman who'd been on this program who told his story, who was still playing his trumpet in his mid-90s, came out and played taps. And to see that moment, to feel that moment, to look up at the quivering salute of my uncle, a retired lieutenant colonel from the Air Force, saluting his father with that flag-draped casket, just thinking about it now gives me goosebumps. But I don't know if I've ever thought about what it's like for the guy playing the taps. I know for those folks, every one of those families, to have a World War II and Korean War veteran playing taps for them meant so much. But over all of those, what did that mean to you, and why was it so important for you to be there and do that?
Comes from the heart. It's just something that feel you have to do.
I mean, that's not just a whim. That's not just a, hey, I've got 15 minutes, I'm going to do that. That took a big commitment, a lot of organization, and an investment on your part.
Yes, that's for sure. And as I say, it started with the Greenlawn River, you might say, when they made requests to have a bugler. Went on from there, instead of just one or two a month or something like that, became that there were numerous. I've done as many as seven in one day at the National Cemetery.
I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and there's one more thing I've heard that I want to make sure is true. Did you really dodge the honor flight for years and years? They kept trying to talk you into going to Washington, D.C. with them, and you just wouldn't go?
Yes, because I felt like I would be depriving some other veteran of his flight to Washington, D.C. And then finally I decided that there was ample room for one more. So I took the flight and was very pleased to have done so, and thank all of those people that are involved in Honor Flight.
So with Honor Flight Kern County, you got to go to Washington, D.C. with your son John as your guardian and share that experience with them at the World War II Memorial and the Korean War Veterans Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial with 58,000 names on it. What did you get out of it? I know you waited a long time to do it, but I can tell you're glad you did finally do it. What did it mean to you?
Grabs your heart and makes you feel like something has taken place.
You know, another question came to mind for me when we were talking about the service you provided for so many veterans' families in their time of need when they're burying a loved one, and you were there to play taps, and even in tandem with another bugler, the echo taps, which adds another level of power and emotion to it. Have you ever thought about someday someone's going to play taps for you?
Absolutely. And at 97, it probably isn't too many days away, or years away at least.
Is there someone that you want to do that for you the way you did for so many others?
No, it's not going to make any difference who performs it.
Well, you do have a lot of life to look back on. It's been a long time since your family left Saskatchewan and came here to the south end of the San Joaquin Valley in California. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. Is there something that you think back on and you say, you know, that right there, that's what I'm most proud of or most satisfied with?
Yes, doing all of the services for our fellow veterans, playing the taps the thousands of times, and Battle Hymn of the Republic while they're folding the flag, and many times making the flag presentation to the next of kin. It's very touching.
Yeah, I can tell that, I mean, you wouldn't have done it as many times if you did, if you didn't see it as a great privilege and an honor to do that. You know, one thing I haven't asked you, as I've heard about some of these close calls and your crazy experiences in the Army Air Corps and then the U.S. Air Force, for everything you've made it through and the fact that some of those other situations you saw others fall victim to or that you came awfully close to suffering from yourself, how do you size that up? How do you evaluate that? Is that sheer luck? Is that happenstance? Do you feel that you were protected somehow? What's your view on that?
Yes, I feel that I was protected. I don't know. It's just one of those things. It's way of life. You live it, and some are more fortunate than others.
And I guess I should ask you in closing, because you've been there for those final moments and the last honor that veterans receive, where families are making sense of it and they're grieving the loss of a loved one who served our country. When you think about those who have given that last measure of devotion, the 400,000 plus who died in World War II, more than 50,000 in the Korean War where you served, and close to 60,000 more in Vietnam, and those today, how should the rest of us who've never worn their uniform, how should we view those who have made that ultimate sacrifice?
Just witness and be cognizant of the fact that they served their country, that it was an honor for them to have served, and so forth. Just grabs you from the heart, that's all.
Bob Otto's dedication grabs me from the heart, and I'm guessing it might be the same feeling for you wherever you're listening right now. I mentioned you could find video online, and some of that is Bob playing his trumpet, but I think if I'm going to tell you about all the times that he's honored his fellow veterans by performing taps at their funerals, we ought to conclude with that very sound from a 97-year-old who just never stops giving. I'm sure you can already guess what Bob said when I put him on the spot before leaving his home and asked him to open his trumpet case and play taps for me. And that is how the program is going to come to an end today. I encourage you, as you listen to Bob play, imagine all those families and how they felt when he played taps for their loved ones. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. As promised, we also get to hear from Bob's son, John, who served as his guardian on that trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County. If you meet someone you've never met before, and they say, "Tell me about your dad," how long of a conversation does that turn into?
Sometimes that conversation gets pretty extended, especially if he's standing next to me. We can talk for minutes or tens of minutes or hours, and it's always fun because he always brings out some new ideas and some new things that have come along in his life, especially with the war, Korean War, and or teaching or whatever else happens to be. It's a good conversation, good conversationalist.
Well, and I can see the respect that you have for him, the pride you take in his life and his example. When you think about what he's meant to you, the things he's taught you, or just why you appreciate him so much, what are the things at the top of your list?
Well, you know, after being here for 66 plus years or 65 years, you know, you want to give back to the people that have given you or created and helped you through your life. And I just try and do that and help him as best I can now, especially when now he needs more help than ever, I think. Because, you know, when my mom was here or when my brother was here, you know, coming in and out of the house or as we were growing up and all, you know, things were easier. And it seems like now that sometimes there's more need for me to be here or to help him along the way. And I think that's a good thing, and I enjoy doing that.
As the years have gone by, have you gained an even deeper understanding of what he did in the service and how significant his contribution was?
Very much so. In fact, you know, when you hear the stories more than one time, not, you know, numerous times really, you realize that there's a lot to the stories. And now once you start digging back into some of the paperwork that he has, like the flying issues or flying documents that he has and the military documents, it's easy to see that, you know, that's a lot to his life. and there were a lot of missions that he went on, like you talked about, that were classified or went on, and you know there were other things that he did, and one time he even carried secret documents and was given a 9mm handgun to go and deliver these documents. And you know, you just take it in stride. You don't even realize at the time what you're doing, but later on it's a big thing. It means an awful lot.
How about if you try to put yourself in his shoes and think about the hazards, the danger that he was in?
Yeah, that's a big thing, especially when you see or know the size of a 50mm round that went through his wing and ignited the canister in there a little bit, and it glowed in the dark, so to speak, as they were flying. That'd almost be terrifying. I mean, you couldn't get back on the ground fast enough. I mean, and it's not as if you can just put on the brakes and land in the 30 seconds. You have to get out of where you are, get back to a base where you can land and land, besides, you know, checking out what happened and everything.
When you hear him tell that story, does the concept of human frailty become even more clearer when you consider that you might never have been born if he didn't make it back from that?
I know. I wouldn't be here. It would be one of those things where, whoops, there wasn't that moment. Exactly right.
What about him would you say that you're most proud of, that's most significant in your mind?
Well, he's my dad. I mean, good grief, I've known him for 65-plus years, and we're best of friends, and my mom, and when she was here, they were the best, and it's just been great times all along the way.
Who do you think got more out of the honor flight, him or you?
I know he did, because I was there to watch it. I know he had a great time. A very good time. Pictures and videos and the honor flight people, what they do and how they did all that, it was just incredible. I mean, that's the most action-packed 2 or 3 days that you've ever had in your life. You've been on a couple yourself, and that's amazing to see all that and see the places in D.C. and get an armchair tour of the Capitol and all of the things that went along with it. It was really a very, very fun and enjoyable trip.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.